Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Every idea starts with a problem. Warby Parker's was simple. Glasses are too expensive. So they set out to change that. By designing glasses in-house and selling directly to customers, they're able to offer prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Warby Parker glasses are made from premium materials like impact-resistant polycarbonate and custom acetate, and they start at just $95, including prescription lenses. Get glasses made from the good stuff. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.
I have a secret. I used to struggle with dull, saggy skin. Then I found Spoiled Child's E27 Liquid Collagen. This extra strength liquid formula, packed with type 1 and type 3 collagen, vitamin C, and hyaluronic acid, makes it so easy to visibly transform your skin and hair. No more chunky collagen powders, just a smooth, delicious liquid that can be blended with any drink. With over 100,000 five-star reviews, this liquid collagen is going viral for a reason. And with their Try Before You Buy offer, you could try your full-size product at home before buying. Take the quiz at spoiledchild.com/quiz. That's spoiledchild.com/quiz.
Deep in the ocean, an orca pod is on the hunt. But these aren't your average orcas. These guys are organized.
Marketing team, did you get those social media posts scheduled for the seal migration?
Aye, aye, Captain. We even have an automated notification for all pod managers when they go live.
They use Monday.com to keep their teamwork sharp, their communication clear, and their goals in sight. Monday.com, for whatever you run, even orcas. Go to Monday.com to dive deeper.
Welcome to the Serial Killer Podcast, the podcast dedicated to serial killers, who they were, what they did, and how. Episode 237. I am your humble host, Thomas Rosaland Vyborg Thune. Last episode, we began looking closer at Terry Melcher and his connection with the Manson family, and the trio he belonged to that called themselves the Golden Penetrators. Tonight, we continue looking closer beneath the glitter and glam of Malibu and Hollywood. Beneath it all, we find something rancid, something foul. Enjoy. This episode, like all other sagas told by me, would not be possible without my loyal Patreonies. They are Elizabeth, Lisa, Kathy, Corbin, Craig, Jonathan, Lunavar, Cheryl, Richard, Brad, Manuel, Ayulin, and Ricky. You are truly the backbone of the Serial Killer Podcast, and without you, there would be no show. Patreon is again filled with ad-free episodes for my TSK Producers Club, and I also have a bonus episode I'm quite happy with for my $10 Plus Club members. It's a movie review, and this time the film in question is the serial killer film Long Legs. So don't miss out and head on over to patreon.com/theserialkillerpodcast now. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide, where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride, till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, 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 yeah. But don't you want me to love you? I'm coming down fast, but I'm miles above you. Tell me, tell me, tell me. Come on, tell me the answer. Well, you may be a lover, but you ain't no dancer. Now helter skelter, helter skelter, helter skelter. Yeah. Well, will you? Won't you? You want me to make you? I'm coming down fast, but don't let me break you. Tell me, tell me, tell me the answer. You may be a lover, but you ain't no dancer. Look out! Helter skelter, helter skelter, helter skelter, ooh. Look out, 'cause here she comes. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. And I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. And I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, don't you want me to make you? I'm coming down fast, but don't let me break you. Tell me, tell me, tell me the answer. You may be a lover, but you ain't no dancer. Look out, helter skelter, helter skelter, helter skelter, ooh. This, dear listener, are the lyrics to the Beatles song Helter Skelter from their album The Beatles, more commonly known as simply The White Album. How in the world Charles Manson drew prophecies of an apocalyptic race war from those, in my view, very, very, very infantile lyrics is beyond me. The song is about a boy and a girl on a playground, perhaps a young man and a young woman on a playground, the lyrics does not say. But it is certainly not about the black man rising up against the white man and both races exterminating each other. There is also nothing at all about a secret cave in Death Valley leading to an underground world where the chosen people can repopulate the world. Manson, adrift from Wilson and his shot at a record deal, saw Terry Melcher as his last lifeline. As his hopes for fame faded, a darkness settled over him. Obsessed with the prophecies of a race war he claimed to hear in the Beatles song Helter Skelter from their album The White Album, his demeanor grew increasingly erratic. Now, I have taken a look at the rest of the White Album to see if there are any clues in the other songs on it. Here are all the songs. Back in the USSR, which is a song about the Soviet Union, Dear Prudence, Glass Onion, Obladi Oblada, which is a simple song about optimism and how life goes on, The Continuing Story of Bungalow Bill, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, Happiness is a Warm Gun, an anti-war song, Martha, My Dear, I'm So Tired, Blackbird, Piggies, which is the first song, aside from Helter Skelter, that Manson obviously drew inspiration from, with the blood graffiti reading pig and death to pigs. Rocky Raccoon, Don't Pass Me By, Why Don't We Do It in the Road, I Will, Julia, Birthday, Your Blues, Mother Nature's Son, Everybody Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey, Sexy Sadie, Helter Skelter, Revolution One, Honey Pie, Savoy Truffle, Cry Baby Cry, Revolution 9, Good Night, which is the final song on the album. Worth noting is the song Revolution 1, whose title makes one think that perhaps the lyrics did inspire Manson directly into violent action. But when we take a look at its lyrics, that theory goes out the window. I quote, But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? End quote. The way I see it, the White Album is a musical masterpiece, an album that certainly revolutionized the musical world. But its songs are great because of their melodies and the way the Beatles performed them. The lyrics are at best shallow and naive, and at worst meaningless sounds strung together because they sound nice and rhyme easily, like obla-dee obla-da and diddly-i-dee. The winter of 1969 brought further despair. Manson meticulously prepared for a meeting with Melcher, only to be stood up. Desperate, he returned to Cielo Drive, the house he remembered at Melcher's residence, and instead of the producer, he encountered Sharon Tate's personal photographer, Sharok Hatami, who knew nothing of Melcher. Hatami directed Manson to the guest house where Rudolf Altobelli, the property owner, confirmed that Melcher had moved out without leaving a forwarding address. Undeterred, Manson turned to Greg Jacobson, a friend and fan of the Girls, to arrange another meeting with Melcher. This time, fate intervened. In May, Melcher made the journey to the Spahn Ranch to audition Manson in person, visiting twice over 4 days. Manson, accompanied by the Girls, performed his songs in a secluded gully. As he sat atop a rock, guitar in hand, the Girls lay sprawled on the ground, their eyes fixed on their charismatic, yet increasingly troubled, leader. Melcher, as a courtesy, offered a tepid compliment to Manson, suggesting that a couple of his songs were nice. However, he had no intention of signing Manson to a record deal. Instead, he saw the family's peculiar, cultish lifestyle as the perfect subject for a TV documentary. Melcher proposed that his friend Mike Deasy, equipped with a van outfitted for field recordings, could visit the ranch to capture another performance. Before Melcher could leave, a drunken ranch foreman, dressed like a cowboy and armed with a gun, stumbled out of a pickup truck. Manson, with a sudden burst of aggression, shouted a threat at the man, shocked him in the gut, seized his gun, and continued to beat him. The incident left Melcher shaken. This was a so-called peace and love cult, yet violence seemed to be a constant undercurrent. He was determined to document this bizarre and dangerous community. A few days later, Melcher returned to the ranch with Deasy and Jacobson. The family performed again, but the spontaneity of their earlier audition was gone, replaced by a rehearsed and contrived performance. Deasy returned several more times, until a terrifying LSD trip with Manson convinced him to stay away. The toxicity of the environment was becoming unbearable. Melcher, through Jacobson, conveyed his final rejection to Manson. With this, Manson's last chance at mainstream success was extinguished, and he descended deeper into a world of apocalyptic fantasies. Melcher, for his part, claimed to have never returned to the ranch or had any further contact with the family. Charles Manson was not charged with murder until November, but the Golden Penetrators had ample reason to suspect Manson already back in August. First, Wilson and Jacobson knew that the Manson family had shot a black man named Bernard Crow about 5 weeks before the Tate murders, and Jacobson, who testified that he'd talked to Manson upward of 100 times, was well acquainted with his friend's bizarre race war predictions. Manson warned him that whiteys in the affluent homes of Bel Air would be cut up and dismembered, and that the murderers would smear the victim's blood on the walls scatter their limbs, and hang them from the ceiling. And yet, when a group of affluent whites really was cut up, and Sharon Tate was hanged from the ceiling of her home in Bel Air, Jacobson apparently didn't make the connection. Nor did it occur to him in mid-August, when he witnessed Manson's violence firsthand. Manson broke into Jacobson's home in the middle of the night, shook him awake, and produced a bullet. "Tell Dennis there are more where this came from," he said. On the witness stand, Jacobson compared Manson that night to a caged bobcat. A few days earlier, Manson had shown up at Wilson's house, too, demanding $1,500. When Wilson refused to give him the money, Manson threatened him in the following manner, and I quote, "Don't be surprised if you never see your kid again," end quote. After Manson's arrest, Wilson fell into a deep depression, spurring his problems with drugs and alcohol. Later, he told the Beach Boys authorized biographer David Leaf, and again I quote, "I know why Charles Manson did what he did. Someday I'll tell the world. I'll write a book and explain why he did it," end quote. He never got the chance. In 1983, 3 weeks after his 39th birthday, an acutely drunk Wilson dove from the deck of his boat into the chilly waters of Marina del Rey and accidentally drowned. Within days, a rock journalist wrote in the San Francisco Chronicle about a jarring experience he'd had with Dennis Wilson. Apparently, Wilson had said, and I quote, "Me and Charlie, we founded the family," end quote. The Golden Penetrators, then, had an abundance of reasons to accuse Manson of the Tate-LaBianca murders immediately. They believed the family had shot someone dead. He had threatened two of them with violence. They knew Manson stockpiled guns and knives at the ranch, and the slaughter at Melcher's old house was exactly the kind Manson had talked about, down to the most chilling detail. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. This month is all about gratitude, especially for my American listeners who are celebrating Thanksgiving. As a Norwegian, I am a little envious of my American friends. November is a month filled with darkness, and here in the high north, winter is well on its way. So, to have a holiday where we sit down with loved ones and eat delicious food and devote time to gratitude sounds like pure bliss. Do you know, dear listener, who all of us need to be more grateful towards? Ourselves. Therapy can help give perspective and remind us that when we are going through rough patches in our lives, one person is doing most of the work. You. And you deserve a pat on the back and a hot cup of cocoa. Everyone needs someone to talk to. Even psychopaths. Even your humble host. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Let the gratitude flow with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/serialkiller today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/serialkiller. This episode is sponsored by Kill List. In a quiet suburb, our community is shattered by the death of a beloved wife and mother. But this tragic loss of life quickly turns into something even darker. Her husband had tried to hire a hitman on the dark web to kill her, and she wasn't the only target. Because buried in the depths of the internet is the Kill List, a cache of chilling documents containing names, photos, addresses, and specific instructions for people's murders. The Kill List podcast is a true story of how one writer ended up in a race against time to warn those whose lives were in danger. Follow Kill List on the Wondery app, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Kill List, or more Exhibit C true crime shows like Morbid, Early, and Ad-Free right now by joining Wondery Plus. Check out Exhibit C in the Wondery app for all your true crime listening.
Folks, we're back in the bottom of the sixth. Lorenzo's on the mound. His slider's been... Wait, is that a cat on the field?
That tabby's really moving. He's past second base.
And Coach Bakerfield's making a grab and... Oh, he missed.
Incredible. Someone give that cat a contract.
But folks, even this incredible cat can't sign up for Lemonade Pet Insurance, but you can. Cover your pet now at lemonade.com/incredible.
Now on to yet another character in the Dance Macabre. The owner of the house on Cielo Drive, Mr. Rudy Altobelli. One of the first openly gay men in Hollywood, he had made a living as a manager. His clients including Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn. In November 1969, 3 months after the murders, before the killers had been found, he shocked the community by filing a lawsuit against Polanski and Sharon Tate's father to recover the damages his property had sustained during the murders. It was an appallingly callous response to seek money from a victim's family because she had bled on Altobelli's carpet as she lay dying. Altobelli had bought the Cielo house in 1963. In May 1966, he rented it to Terry Melcher, who was known at the time for having produced the Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man and Turn, Turn, Turn. Altobelli liked to befriend his tenants. He'd live in the guest house and rent out the main property, and soon the two became what he called asshole buddies. Whether this term meant the two engaged in casual anal sex, or if they simply saw each other as assholes, only Altobelli knows. Not only was Altobelli one of the few people who befriended both Melcher and Tate, he was one of the few who had seen Manson on the property before the murders. He provided critical testimony for the state, identifying Manson as the man who'd barged into his guest house looking for Terry Melcher on the 23rd of March 1969. His ID was reliable. He'd already met Manson at Dennis Wilson's house the summer before. When he heard about the murders, he thought of Manson right away. Altobelli was in Rome at the time, and his memories troubled him enough that within hours of the murders, before he'd even boarded a flight home, he called his lawyer, Barry Hirsch, told him he should mind his own business. Altobelli returned to Los Angeles, hoping to move back into his house right away. The LAPD forbade him. Instead, he crashed with Melcher and Candice Bergen at their place in Malibu. That house belonged to Doris Day, Melcher's mother, but she seldom used it. During Altobelli's stay, Greg Jacobson stopped by and invited him for a walk on the beach. As they strolled along the surf, past beautiful oceanfront homes fortified in recent weeks with fences, guard dogs, and security systems, Jacobson told him, and here I quote, about the musician that Manson was supposed to have killed, end quote. It is likely Jacobson referred to Gary Hinman, a musician who had been killed by the family 13 days before the Tate-LaBianca murders. If Jacobson knew about that murder, he would have certainly connected the Tate-LaBianca deaths to Manson too. The murder of Hinman is not widely reported on, which is strange, since both the butchery at Cielo Drive and the double murder of the LaBiancas happened only 1 month after. The killer was, again, not Charles Manson himself, but Bobby Beausoleil. As part of a jailhouse interview, Beausoleil detailed Hinman's relationship to the family, the circumstances around the 34-year-old musician's death, and why Beausoleil felt he had no way out other than going forward with his brutal act. Hinman, a talented piano player who once played at Carnegie Hall, was described by his cousin as a lost artistic soul, one who would wind up falling in with the wrong crowd and befriending the Manson family. The Manson family members had been to Hinman's house several times before his murder. Beausoleil had purchased drugs from Hinman during the summer of 1969. He sold them to another person, who then complained about their quality, causing Beausoleil to need his money back. But Hinman didn't have the money. After Beausoleil, an aspiring actor and musician, roughed Gary up a bit, he called Manson, who decided to come to the house with a samurai sword. When he arrived, Manson took the sword and made a swipe across Hinman's face from his ear down to his cheek. Beausoleil asked Manson why he had cut the man's face, to which Manson answered, and I quote, "to show you how to be a man." End quote. Beausoleil then tried to make nice with Hinman, applying a bandage and telling him to relax. Hinman, however, was having none of it. He demanded they take him to the emergency room for treatment. Beausoleil knew that if he took Hinman there, he would end up in jail, and he did not want that. So instead, Hinman was tortured over 3 days before he was killed. Beausoleil, for his part, admitted to stabbing Hinman twice in the chest. The Manson family reportedly used Hinman's blood to scribble the words "political piggy" on the wall after the murder, and also included a panther paw to try and pin the slaying on the Black Panthers. Beausoleil was sentenced to death for his role in Hinman's murder, but the sentence was later commuted to life in prison. If Altobelli was telling the truth, then all four of these men, him, Melcher, Wilson, Jacobson, the main links between Manson, Hollywood, and the house on Cielo Drive, had to know that Manson was behind the murders, and yet all they wanted to do was forget about it. 3 weeks after the crimes, Altobelli moved back into the house on Cielo Drive with Melcher as his new roommate, an arrangement that has never been public knowledge until recently. Altobelli returned out of a desire to reclaim his home from the evil that had infested it. He hoped to restore some order to the place, but then it had become a morbid mecca for Hollywood's elite, who came by wanting a glimpse at the scene of the crime. Even Elvis Presley came to pay his respects. Altobelli turned most of these visitors away, but he welcomed Melcher, who'd expressed a bizarre yearning to stay in his old place again. With Altobelli's blessing, Melcher lived there for a month, maybe longer. He hardly left the property at all during that time. Carol Wilson was Dennis Wilson's ex-wife. It was after their second separation that Dennis had taken up with Manson and the girls, much to Carol's chagrin. The two shared custody of their two kids. Later, Carol had photos taken at Dennis' house, capturing him cavorting naked around the pool with women from the family. She used those photos to pressure Dennis, getting him to agree to her terms in the divorce settlement. Carol kept careful tabs on her ex's going-ons. Meanwhile, she pursued a romance with Jay Sebring. When asked if Manson's reach in Hollywood was further than had been generally reported in the media, she said sure it was, but refused to give any more detailed information. She stated, even though decades had passed by then, The Manson affair was a scary thing that had many powerful people involved. Bugliosi, in his book Helter Skelter, wrote, and I quote, "After Terry Melcher had moved out of the Cielo Drive residence, but before the Polanskis had moved in, Greg Jacobson had arranged for a Dean Morehouse to stay there for a brief period. During this time, Tex Watson had visited Morehouse at least 3 and possibly as many as 6 times." End quote. This was the only time in his book that Morehouse is mentioned. Dean Morehouse was a disillusioned Protestant minister, insurance salesman, and married father of 3. He was living a mundane life in San Jose when his path crossed with Charles Manson in 1967. The charismatic ex-con, fresh out of federal prison, hitchhiked his way into Morehouse's life, a seemingly innocuous encounter that would have profound consequences. Morehouse, already adrift from his ministry and entangled in legal troubles for forgery, was drawn to Manson's promises of spiritual enlightenment. Meanwhile, Manson was more interested in Morehouse's 15-year-old daughter, Ruth Ann. Before long, Manson had absconded with the young girl on a trip up the California coast, prompting her mother to report her as a runaway. By March 1968, Morehouse's life had spiraled further out of control. He faced arrest for contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and later for selling LSD, a drug he allegedly first tried under Manson's influence. As he embraced the counterculture and grew a long white beard, Morehouse continued to pursue his daughter, who had remained with the family and had been renamed Uich by Manson. Morehouse had been arrested on a drug charge in Ukiah, California. In the midst of his time with the family, he had to head back north for his trial. In January of 1969, Morehouse was placed in prison. This makes Bugliosi's timeline completely wrong. Again, it seems as if Bugliosi was trying to minimize the Golden Penetrator's involvement with the Manson family. It further turns out that Bugliosi's key witness, an outlaw biker named Dennis DiCarlo, had told Bugliosi that Terry Melcher had visited the Manson family not once, not twice, but 3 times after the murders. In an interview with Bugliosi on the 11th of February 1970, DiCarlo described Melcher's 2 visits to the Spahn Ranch in late August and early September 1969, and his 3rd visit to the Barker Ranch, more than 200 miles away, in mid-September. None of this is included in the book Helter Skelter. At the grand jury hearing in December 1969, Bugliosi had asked Melcher whether he ever saw Manson after his May 1969 visit to the Spahn Ranch. "No, I didn't," Melcher replied under oath. During the trial, Bugliosi asked him again, "After this 2nd occasion that you went to the Spahn Ranch, which was a couple of days after May the 18th, 1969, did you ever see Mr. Manson thereafter?" "No," Melcher said, again under oath. Next, he was cross-examined by the defense's Paul Fitzgerald, who asked, "Do you recall the last time you saw Charles Manson?" Melcher replied, "Yeah, just a few days after May the 18th, at the ranch." 3 different times on the stand, always as a witness for Bugliosi, Melcher lied about not seeing Manson after May 1969.
How did you actually sleep last night? If it didn't feel like your very best rest, then you need to upgrade to the softest, most luxurious bedding from Boll & Branch. Their signature sheets are made from the finest 100% organic cotton and get softer with every wash. Millions of sleepers love their sheets, and right now, you can feel the difference for yourself during their biggest sales of the entire year. Hurry to bollandbranch.com to shop their best offers. Limited time only. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Shorter days and chillier nights can make it tough to keep up your fall workout routine. Thankfully, there's Allo Moves, the app that brings health and wellness to the comfort of your home. Allo Moves offers yoga, Pilates, strength workouts, and other fitness classes, plus wellness offerings like meditations, sound baths, and more. Whether you have 5 minutes or an hour, Allo Moves has a class or flow that saves you from a frigid trip to the gym. Get a 30-day free trial and 20% off an annual membership with code ACAST at allomoves.com.
Every idea starts with a problem. Warby Parker's was simple. Glasses are too expensive. So they set out to change that. By designing glasses in-house and selling directly to customers, they're able to offer prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Warby Parker glasses are made from premium materials like impact-resistant polycarbonate and custom acetate. And they start at just $95, including prescription lenses. Get glasses made from the good stuff. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.
If Melcher had committed outright perjury, suborned by Bugliosi, then the veracity of the prosecutor's entire case, including the extraordinary hippie race war motive that made him a best-selling author, is called into question. And with that, we come to the end of part 6 in this series covering Charles Manson. Next episode continues this exposé, so as they say in the land of radio, stay tuned.